So welcome everyone to this day of mindfulness here in Tampa. Is there anyone here who this is their first day of mindfulness? Is there anyone here this is their first time at this center? Anyone here this is their first time ever meditating? Oh, you're a brave soul. Well, you'll probably do the best today because you have no preconceptions about how anything's supposed to be, so you can be just free and easy, open to everything. That's good. So before we begin with the formal talk, for new people and old people, in terms of the practices we've done today or anything that has been shared in the instructions, are there any questions about anything? One's own meditative experience, any issues, problems that have arisen that you have any questions about, please feel free to ask anything. Yes. Yeah, again, you know, again, we don't live in a culture where we sit on the floor or we sit, so usually sitting cross-legged, there is some level of uncomfortableness. But the reason for a cushion is to get those knees down. Maybe MT can help you. Yeah, so these cushions, sitting on a cushion, it's kind of come along with meditation from Asian countries, and there are different kinds of cushion, but the idea is to kind of get your, you want to get your knees down. What? Yeah, and you kind of sit at the edge of the cushion, which kind of, you know, by bringing your bottom up, your knees go down, and that, yeah, there you go. And that's kind of, I mean, that may be stretching things a bit, but does that feel better, kind of a little more balanced? Yeah, so you want to get those knees down, because if you're sitting short term, it doesn't matter, but if you're sitting longer, kind of having your spine out of balance can be, you know, can make it uncomfortable. But that being said, for many people, just sitting cross-legged for a period of time, there's some degree of uncomfortableness. Just natural. Again, the challenge is we live in a culture where discomfort is seen as a negative. And when we are physically uncomfortable, and even more so mentally uncomfortable, we immediately want to get rid of that discomfort, don't we? If our head hurts a little bit, we want to take something. If our body hurts a little bit, we want to take something, or at least we want to change the posture. If we're not happy with our mood, we immediately want to take something to change it. So we're always, if it's a little too warm, we immediately want to turn the AC down. As soon as we're a little cold, we want to turn the AC back up, and it's like, boop, boop, you know. And we find that as we move around the world, if things aren't quite right the way we want it, we find there is an annoyance, an irritation, or something, and we want to change it. This is, we might say, from a psychological point of view, this is all suffering, because there's no ease in that kind of response. So learning to sit with some degree of physical discomfort, again, I'm not talking about the kind of pain which is really significant, you know what I mean, like our bodies are really out of whack or something is being done injurious, but just the discomfort of, you know, again, sitting much longer than we're used to, please notice that rather than just holding that quote-unquote discomfort in mindfulness and awareness and just kind of letting it be, we immediately create a story around it. We become obsessive about it, and you might spend your whole meditation just being concerned about your discomfort, wanting to move, and praying for the bell. And then the bell rings, and you undo your legs, and your discomfort's gone. And like, you know, you might ask yourself, what was I making such a big deal about? Right? Why did I spend half the meditation obsessing about, these sensations? They're just sensations. Even to call them uncomfortable is a label we're giving them, right? They are just sensations. And again, learning to be with sensations and to acknowledge sensations, but not have to always react. It's sort of like many people, if they have an itch, they kind of immediately, scratch it, right? Or if they're uncomfortable, they immediately got to move. I mean, we're always driven. I mean, it's very interesting. Sometimes you may, for those of you who find itches some kind of terrible infliction or affliction, you might make that the source of your practice one time and just ask yourself, what is an itch? You know what I mean? As a sensation. And if you're just present to it as a sensation, you might find it's just a mildly uncomfortable sensation that is short term. Nothing to get disturbed about, or you know what I'm saying? So you can use these uncomfortablenesses that arise in your body during meditation as ways of kind of deepening your ease and your kind of acceptance of the way things are without always needing to what? We always need to change and manipulate. We're always manipulating. We don't like our bodily sensations, we always manipulate. We don't like our emotional sensations, our thoughts, we're always manipulating. And that takes work. And there is another way, which is just to be aware of. Right? And you may find that when you stop the drama and you're just present, that things are not as bad as we thought they were. So that's a good thing to do. In the same way, when we're in meditation, we may have thoughts, you know. Anybody have thoughts that they didn't like having today, right? You know, it's like a, or they may have an emotion that comes up that they don't like having. I don't want to have this. But that reaction to a thought or a feeling is not coming from the thought or the feeling, is it? The thought or the feeling is just a thought of a feeling or a feeling. It has no problem being what it is. But there's something within us that has discomfort or judgment or criticism about what is arising in our minds, the same way does about the body. And that again causes us always to react and try to manipulate or control what's going on. Much better just to relax and let things be. And actually look right at it. What is a thought? Rather than always reacting to them. What is a thought? Look right at it. What is a feeling? What does a feeling actually feel like? If I didn't call it bad or good or sad or happy, I just looked right at it. What is it? Right? And you may be surprised by what you find. Any other questions about the practices or what we've done so far today? Is everyone clear about what a day of mindfulness is about? Of course, I didn't mention earlier, but it's a given that it's a day of silence. Again, silence in and of itself, a day of silence is a wonderful thing. Just to kind of have not all that activity and stimulation and talking going on, but just quiet. So one can kind of feel oneself and be present to oneself. And also be among 40 or 50 other people and all, very involved in a meaningful activity and yet, not getting in each other's ways. You know, it's kind of being together, but at the same time being alone. being with others, feeling their support, feeling the commonality of the practice, and yet at the same time, knowing that the work essentially has to go on in our own minds. Right? So before I begin the talk, are there any... Yes, you have a question? Oh, this. You're new today. This means this is the way we put our hands together. So you got to be really careful about that. You can't just get away with rubbing your hands together here. Okay. So today, and again, for those who just wandered in, I don't know your background in Buddhism or Zen. This may be a little bit of a stretch, but I don't think so. I want to read some selections from one of the great Chinese Zen masters. His name was Lin Chi. And Lin Chi, from his many... He lived in the 9th century, sort of... don't think they know when he was born, but he died somewhere around 850, 860. And I think he died in his mid-50s. And he had many disciples who went on to those disciples, and disciples began to be known as one of the major schools of what was... people are familiar with the word Zen. Well, Zen in Chinese is Chan, C-H-A-N. So Zen is just the Japanization of Chan, right? So, and Chan came before Zen, because Chan, when it came to China first, and then went to Japan. And so Lin Chi became one of the great masters and schools of Chinese Chan, and his school the Lin Chi school. For those of you familiar with Japanese Zen, if you heard the word Rinzai Zen, that's Rinzai is Lin Chi. That's again the pronunciation in Japanese. Lin Chi was known for his very straight-ahead kind of teaching. He's known for his shouts, and he's known for his stick. He would shout, and he would hit. It wasn't beating in any way. He was trying to wake people up, and he had a very direct method that did not rely on words. So he was quite known for his shout and for his stick. But even though he is well known for his shout and his stick, he also spoke. And his teachings were very direct and clear. Much of what is known about him was recorded by his disciples. I'm not sure if he ever wrote anything. So most of them were, I believe maybe all of them, were just... his disciples wrote down some of his talks that he would give in the meditation hall or some dialogues. And in those days, they didn't have earpieces to deal with either. So this is from this teachings of Lin Chi, or the record of Lin Chi, as they're called. And I'm reading from an anthology, actually, even though there is this called the Zen Teaching of Rinzai, which is translated from the Chinese and is a fuller record. This is the actual, all these records of his teachings. But I'm reading from, it's called The Roaring Stream. It's an anthology that has many, many, many Chinese and Japanese teachings of various kinds of teachers and dialogues. So this is much shorter, okay? But it's a good translation. So it begins. The master, that's Lin Chi, instructed the group. So again, it's in the meditation hall, and he's... talking to whoever is present. So he begins, followers of the way. Okay? Now this is the way of awakening. There are many ways, there are many paths in life. But when they say followers of the way with a capital W, he's talking about that he's extending the olive branch to everyone who is in the present, saying, I'm calling you all followers of the way, followers of the truth, followers of the Dharma. Okay? Followers of the way of awakening. The Dharma of the Buddhas, in this case, the teachings and understanding of the Buddhas, calls for no special undertakings. So right away, this is kind of special, right? Because many people think, to follow a spiritual life, follow the path of awakening, follow the Dharma of the Buddha. There's all kinds of things we got to do, right? All kinds of things we got to study, and all kinds of rules we need to follow, and all kind of robes we get. And these are probably probably mostly monastics. So all kind of robes we got to put on, and all kinds of rituals we need to do, and right? So we think, following a spiritual path, a path of awakening, there's a lot I got to do, right? It's a lot of work. Right? Many people go, if you knew what's going on inside my mind, you know I got a lot of work to do. Right? Got a lot of things I got to undertake to get this, my act together. So he says, followers of the way, the Dharma of the Buddhas calls for no special undertakings. So again, please understand how kind of radical this is, right? In a very traditional setting. Just act ordinary without trying to do anything particular. So this is very important to hear what he's saying, right? Just act ordinary. What does ordinary mean? It means as you are. You don't have to do anything special. Many people think to enter a spiritual path, you have to act spiritual. Dress spiritual, talk spiritual, right? Watch spiritual videos, and I don't know what else. Listen to spiritual talks, right? See, so many people think there's something special we have to do. He says, just don't do anything particular. Act ordinary. Move your bowels, piss, get dressed, eat your rice, and if you get tired, then lie down. Okay? Now that's kind of wonderful, right? Because I'm sure everybody in here can relate to that, right? You say, oh, I can do that. You see how wonderful it is? I mean, I may not be able to, meditate 24 hours. I may not be able to have a totally concentrated mind without thoughts. I may not be able to do this. Oh, but I can certainly move my bowels, piss, get dressed, eat my rice, eat my food, and when I'm tired, sleep. So this Dharma, this path of Zen, you see, is accessible to everyone. That is its beauty. Move your bowels, piss, get dressed, eat your rice, and if you're tired, then lay down. And then he says, fools may laugh at me, but those who are wise will know what I mean. Right? Fools will laugh at me, but those who are wise will understand what I'm saying. A fool is somebody what? Who doesn't understand. Right? So they're going to laugh when somebody says, oh, the highest teachings, the highest practices of following the Buddha, just be totally ordinary. It's no different than anything you're doing right now. You know, fools will laugh at me, but people who understand will understand what I mean. Does everybody here understand what he means? Does anybody not understand? Don't be shy. Really, everybody gets it. Does anybody not quite understand what Lynchy's getting at?
Obviously, it's more to it than just being ordinary, because I'm always
No, the trouble is, you're not always ordinary. The ordinariness he's talking about is an ordinariness that is free of all thought, free of all artifice, free of all self-image, free of all sense of self and other, right? This is the ordinariness, right? This is why this is so profound. This is the ordinariness where there's nothing left over. That whatever you're doing, you're on the bathroom, you're eating, you're going through your day, you're just totally, absolutely present with a totally empty, spacious mind. There's, you're not conditioned by anything. Is that clear? That's the ordinariness of he's referring to. We might call it, to help people like Brian, we may call it an extraordinary kind of ordinariness. Because the ordinariness of most of us is not that free, right? As we go about our day, our minds are just constantly filled with self-consciousness and expectations and ideas, and all our interchanges are filled with dramas and mini-dramas and melodramas and emotional ups and downs, right? He's not talking about any of that. That's not being ordinary in the sense he means. So to have that kind of freedom and ease, that one is so relaxed that one can just be ordinary. Every day just ordinary. There's a wonderful saying in Zen, every day is a good day when nothing hangs in the mind. I don't know if you've heard that. Right? Most people can't say that, can they? Most people can't say every day is a good day. Most people say what? Well, I have good days and bad days. Right? How's your day going? Well, it's a good day today. Most people say it's a good day today. Why? Because things are going their way. Right? And they'll say, how's your day going? Not too good. Why not? You know, because things aren't going my way. Right? Or I'm preoccupied, or I'm obsessed. Or, right? So, but every day is a good day when nothing hangs in the mind. The mind is free. And then every day is a good day. Whatever comes, whether things go your way, things don't go your way, it's all good. Right? Because your mind is ease. Fools may laugh at me, but wise men will know what I mean. A man of old said, and so he's quoting probably some prior teacher, people who try to do something about what is outside themselves are nothing but blockheads. Shall we read that again? You can see Lynchy is, he doesn't mess around. Okay? People who try to do something about what is outside themselves are nothing but blockheads. Now, there are people in this room who have spent their whole life, right up to this moment, always doing something about everybody and everything else. They're always looking outside. And they're always trying to manipulate and control, right? Does that create ease? Does that create well-being? And does it really make a difference in all your attempts to control and manipulate what's around us? Right? In most cases, it just exhausts us or frustrates us. And it often causes other people to be frustrated with us. And usually all our attempts at controlling the external world, most of it comes to naught. Not because we don't try hard enough, but because there are so many variables unfolding in this world and in each individual, that to think that we have the power to control and manipulate the external world is nothing but arrogance or ignorance. Right. Now again, that doesn't mean that we are indifferent to the world around us and the people around us, and we don't act in a wise and intelligent, compassionate way, but we do that with this kind of understanding that always trying to control and manipulate those around us, our external conditions, and the world itself and the people in us is ultimately a frustrating situation if one is expecting the results one's expecting. If you can do it without any attachment to results, then it's much easier. There's more ease. But for beginning, especially for people who are trying to, again, everything is a developmental piece, so it's often important. You know, there's a saying in Zen, before I began the practice, I thought mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. And then when I got into the practice, all of a sudden I learned mountains aren't mountains and rivers aren't rivers. And then at the end of practice, once again I understand mountains are just mountains and rivers are just rivers. So in the beginning, it's like Brian said, we think we know what ordinariness is. But we really don't. So we begin a process of cultivation, learning, at which point we learn that what we always thought was true is not true. Right? That's where we kind of learn that mountains aren't mountains and rivers aren't rivers. But in the end, it'll all get simple again. But we have to go through this uprooting. We have to uproot all our wrong thinking, all our wrong notions, which leads us to suffering. Why are we always trying to control the world and the people around us and situations? Because we think if we do that, then we'll be happy, or we'll be safe, or we'll be secure, or we'll be free of anxiety, or all this stuff, right? Why are we endlessly accumulating things and going after experiences, etc.? Because we think if we get what we want, then we'll be happy. Right? We think things that are essentially impermanent are permanent. We think things that really have no value have value. So in real spiritual cultivation, there has to be this process of undoing, unlearning. Is that clear? So what he says here, people who try to do something about what is outside themselves are nothing but blockheads. This is good for us to hear. Because for many of us, we cannot go from acting in the world and acting in relationships in an egocentric, ignorant kind of deluded way to immediately acting in the world in an enlightened and an awake way. There has to be a process that gets us from here to there. And so it is often good, you know, oftentimes to say to somebody, I'm not sure the right thing to say. People say, well, I'm not sure the right thing to say. Well, then don't say anything. Oh, I never thought of that. You know, it's like, don't say anything. You know, keep your mouth shut. You know, if you're not sure what would be the most helpful or meaningful thing that could really be of benefit to somebody, don't say anything. Right? Is that clear? You know, don't do it. You know, if you're not sure what action would be really skillful or helpful, maybe it'd be good just not to do anything for a while and get your own act together. Right? Maybe once you get your own act together, you'll be better able to help other people get their act together. But we don't live in that world, do we? You know, we think we're experts on everybody but ourselves. Right? We're great at telling everybody else what they should do. And yet we don't have the slightest idea how to do that for ourselves. Because we still are lost in our own conditioning, our own delusions, our own afflictive emotions. And yet we're so good at helping other people see through theirs or get out of theirs. So, a man of old said, people who try to do something about what is outside themselves are nothing but blockheads. I guess a blockhead is somebody who's got a head like a block of wood. I'm not sure what a blockhead is, but something like that. Not much going on inside there. If, wherever you are, you take the role of host, then whatever spot you stand in will be a true one. Then whatever circumstances surround you, they can never pull you awry. Even if you're faced with bad karma left over from the past, or you've committed the five crimes that will bring you into a realm of incessant suffering, these will of themselves become the great sea of emancipation. Everybody get that? So, if wherever you are, you take the role of host. And I was talking about host and guest is a very traditional way in Zen to describe how to practice, and especially how to practice with phenomena. Phenomena in Buddhism means all the things that our senses are aware of, right? So, our eyes see objects, our ears hear sounds, our nose smell odors, our mouth tastes flavors, our body senses sensations, and our mind is the objects of our mind are thoughts, feelings, and perceptions, emotions. Is that clear? So all these things, right, are called guests. Because they don't stay. Right? The things you're hearing now are not the things you heard an hour ago or a minute ago. The thoughts you're thinking now are not the thoughts you thought yesterday or last night or 5 minutes ago. Right? The things you see, the things you smell. Things are constantly changing. Everything's changing. Right? In the world of change, all these things that are constantly changing are simply called, in this analogy, guests. So what is the host? You see? Right? If you are hosting somebody for the weekend in your home, you're the host, right? They come, they stay, and after a few days, you hope they probably will leave. Right? It is the nature. But you, when they leave, you will say goodbye to them, won't you? And you will stay in your house. Right? And then it could be, let's say it's a busy season. The next day, some other guests come. Very different than the first guest. Again, you're a good host, aren't you? And then one day you will say goodbye to them. Again, and you remain. Okay? You're the host. Is that clear? And all the ones who come and go are phenomena. You're the one who stays. This is your home. Right? Is that clear? Now, what does that mean in terms of what we're talking about here today? Okay? If I said to you, are you aware of, let's say you're looking at me, are you aware that you're seeing me? Just nod your head if you are. Okay. Are you aware of hearing the sound of my voice? Good. Are you aware that you have a nose? Are you aware that you have taste in your mouth? Are you aware of your body? Can you feel your body? Are you aware of your body? Are you aware of any thoughts that are in your mind if you watched your mind? Any thoughts that are arising, are you aware of them? Okay. So in all of that, even though we are moving from one sense organ to another and to the mind itself, the one thing that is common among all of that is this awareness, right? There is something that is aware of sights, aware of sounds, aware of smells, aware of sensation, aware of thoughts, aware of feelings, all these things that are constantly changing. There is something that has stayed constant. Do you know what that is? For now, we'll just call it your awareness. You are aware of. This is your host, for starters. It's more to it than that, but for now, this is the host. Is that clear? Now, what is your problem? Your problem is you don't identify with the host, you identify with what? The guests. Right? You're endlessly identifying with the guests, the ones that come and go. You're the host. Let them be who they are. You know they're not going to stay, right? You know when some of your relatives come, you know. You can put up with them. Why can you put up with them? Because you know what? They're going to leave. Right? So you know this is just temporary. Right? And my home, where I am at home, my home where I am at peace, that will remain. Right? Because it was my home before they came. They can come in and they can be who they are and right, even stir things up a bit, right? But then when they go, what? Immediately when the door is closed, what? You have your home back again, right? Just like it was. Is that clear? Now, what this cultivation is about is developing that capacity within one's own mind, right? That one knows oneself as the host. One knows oneself as this basic awareness, mindfulness, whatever you want to call it. And that all the things that occur in life, they just come and go. So you're not disturbed. But as long as you take, as long as you identify with the guests, right? You know, some people, you know, so they'll have somebody come over. You know, there'll be some kind of incident and people will talk about it for days, right? I can't believe so-and-so did, could you, you know what I mean? And you'll be talking about it and you'll be thinking about it and you'll wake up in the night with it, you'll wake up in the morning with it. I can't believe so, you know, right? I mean, they've already left. They left days ago. They might have left weeks ago. Why are we still, right, going on and on about it? Why is it? Because we identify with the guests and we don't again identify with the host. As soon as they're out the door, they're gone. You have your home back again. Why not enjoy it? Instead, what do? We keep riled up. Right? Some incident happens. It's over. Comes and it goes. But we what? We hold on to it. Milk it for every bit of misery we can get from it. Right? Why is that? Because we identify with the guests. We don't identify with the host. Is that clear what he's talking about here? If wherever you are, you take the role of host, then whatever spot you stand in will be a true one. Wouldn't that be nice? Wherever you are, whatever situation you are, is a true experience. You're just aware. You're just present. You're just responding to things freely. There's no great emotionality. There's no great obsession. There's no great anything, right? That's why it's a true one. That's why it's authentic. That's why it's utterly ordinary. then whatever circumstances surround you, you can never be pulled awry. Right? Many people go through life without that kind of inner stability, that inner kind of groundedness. Is that clear? And so we're always pulled into the world of emotionality. We're always pulled into the world. It's like we can't watch an ad without wanting it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like we're so monkey see, monkey do. All we need is some kind of advertisement or some kind of something, and immediately we want it. Right? Somebody tells us, oh, there's a new restaurant, blah, 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 or a new ice cream place, and immediately what? Oh, I gotta go there. New movie, I gotta go there. New show on TV, oh, I gotta watch it. Right? It's like, why? See, immediately we are drawn in. Right? Immediately we go after. As if somehow you've never been to a restaurant before. You've never been to an ice cream. You know what I mean? You've never watched a show on TV or seen a movie. You know. Oh, it's new, it's exciting. But after you watch it, then what? You can watch it again and again and again? No, you've watched it. I'm done with that one. What's next? I mean, that's how fickle our mind is. Something we were so excited about and we had to have and we had to watch and we had to consume, all of a sudden, no, I'm not interested in that. Give me something new. Right? Whatever circumstances surround you, you can never be pulled away. Pulled away from what? From your home. From your home. Your home, where is your home? Your home is right here. With a mind that is relaxed, open, grounded, stable, aware, totally present to everything, but doesn't get caught on everything. You know, we're like that rat, you know, endlessly running around in the maze to get the cheese, or going around on that wheel, you know, endlessly, always trying to get something, never at peace. If wherever you are, you take the role of host, then whatever spot you stand in will be a true one. Then whatever circumstance around you, you can never be pulled awry. Even if you're faced with bad karma left over from the past. Anybody here ever faced with bad karma left over from the past? Okay, right. So see what he's saying here. This is important. We may be here following a path of dharma, of mindfulness, spirituality, or whatever path you're following. Because why? Because you want to be what kind of person? You want what? You want to be a good person, or you might want what? You want to be a happy person. You may want to be a compassionate person. Right? You don't want to suffer anymore. I'm going to follow a path. I'm just going to have kind thoughts and loving thoughts. Right? I'm not going to get angry again. I'm not going to be selfish again. I'm not going to always be judgmental and critical. You know what I mean? I'm not going to do any of these things anymore. I'm just going to be an ocean of love. Right? Just going through life, just surrounding everybody with love and light wherever I go. Right? And then what happens? Your bad karma comes along with you. You think you can leave it behind just because you imagine some imaginary reality for yourself. But the truth is, we are at this moment nothing other than what has conditioned us. And all of us in this room have been conditioned. Right? We started out just as like this little thing with no language, very simple, right? And then we almost immediately have been conditioned by experience, by family, by parents, by situations, by schools, by our society. Right? We don't realize that the way we are now is just our conditioning. And in responding to all those situations, we developed a whole range of thoughts and feelings and emotions about who we are and who we're not and who everybody else is, how the world is. And so we have this whole conditioned world that we think is real. We forget that we didn't begin this way. And this is also not the way really our minds are in its true nature. We all have our conditioning, we all have our karma, and the thoughts and feelings and behaviors and words that spontaneously and naturally arise in our mind is the manifestation of our past. We cannot set it aside, can we? Have you noticed that? Even though you imagine yourself as a fountain of light and love, right? Kind of going through the world about 6 inches off, you're so light. In truth, you know how it really is, don't you? Inside your minds. So, he says here, even if you're faced with bad karma left over from the past, or the five crimes that bring you into a realm of incessant suffering, like maybe you've done really, you've had a rough life, and been in all kinds of really traumatic, terrible situations. That it almost sometimes these mind states are not just simply afflictive, sometimes it feels like you've descended into a hell, right? A living hell. Some people are like that. He says, even if that occurs, these will be of themselves become the great sea of emancipation. Very important, right? For many people, the things that arise continually in their mind, even after they have sort of committed themselves to a spiritual path or a path of transformation, is very disturbing to them. It's very frustrating to them. It's very overwhelming to them. Is that clear? But again, see what he's saying, that if one really gets it about host and guest and really begins to identify clearly with host and not the guest, even all this negativity or afflictive thoughts or feelings or behaviors that are still arising from our past conditioning become the sea of emancipation. Now, why is that? Because this stuff that is arising, this all this afflictive stuff that's arising, all this big, heavy-duty stuff that people think they got to work through, it's not like that at all, is it? All these things that are arising are simply what? Thoughts, feelings, impulses, right? Am I missing anything? Again, what is actually arising in your minds that you consider your heavy-duty karma? Yes. What? Yes. Yeah, they're all guesses. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions are just guesses. They just arise and they will disappear. They just come and go. So if you have correct understanding, even all this afflictive stuff, memories. What is a memory? Right? Many people are traumatized by memories. Right? Because they, in their mind, they still see these memories as something real and alive. But it's not like that. That may be hard for some people to hear, but it's really not like that. Your memories are simply like like images from a movie projected on the screen of your mind. Your mind is blank. It is white. It's just aware. And then these memories just are projected on it. And one knows, one can go to a movie, a sad movie, a scary movie, a horror movie, all kinds of movies that all kinds of terrible things happen, and one can sit there and have all kinds of emotional experiences, and then when the movie's over, what happens? You walk out. Right? Why is that? Because you know, essentially, what went on in that movie is not real in any real inherent way, is it? In the same way, all our memories are not real. None of them are real. Real means what? That they're just images in the mind about something that happened that was real 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. Right? They're not real in any inherent sense. They're just, you know, mind stuff, images. That's all they are. And when you can see them as such, when you look right at them and see them as such, they will lose their power to afflict you. It doesn't mean they don't arise. And it doesn't mean when they first arise, they don't arise with a certain kind of energy that is calling to us. Right? And in the past, we have always what? When this all this negative stuff arises, when it calls to us, we traditionally what? Yeah, we answer the call. Oh, come on in. Come on in misery, come on in suffering, come on in depression, come on in worry, come on in trauma. Yeah, I'll just play it all through again. Right? That's the way we've always done it. And so therefore it stays alive. It can stay alive for decades, 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 if we handle it unskillfully. When you know the nature of phenomena, especially mental phenomena, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, and you see them for what they are, they can become, as he says, they'll arise within the sea of emancipation. In the past, they've arisen in the sea of suffering for us. Is this clear to everybody? There may be people going, what is he talking about? Or if he knew what goes on in my mind, it's not like that at all. Or my memories seem very real to me. My thoughts seem very real to me. So please, if you're thinking like that, please ask a question. Don't just take what I'm saying at face value if it doesn't make sense to you. Or if you don't think you can apply it. Yes.
When the idea of the host becomes sort of a guest, where it becomes an idea to attach yourself to,
right,
in order to become your identity of being the host.
Right, so that's good. So there's a process, right? Again, spiritual life is developmental. It's not like you get it like that, right? So again, it's a process. Obviously, if host is just a thought and not an experience, it won't be too strong. And it's very easy to lose it. Because again, it's just another idea. It is a better idea than guests. So in a certain sense, I mean, people often say, hey, but I thought all thoughts are not real, or all beliefs. And, you know, or somebody say, hey, I mean, you know, in Buddhism they say, have no attachments. Isn't Buddhism an attachment to you? Or isn't Dharma an attachment to you? And my sense is, well, ultimately you're right, but for where you're at, it's a good one. You know, it's a better attachment than your, you know, than all your bad attachments. So oftentimes, you know, in our practice, we need to replace bad thoughts with good thoughts, bad ideas with good ideas, right? But ultimately, we would like to have an experience of what it's like to be the host And that experience is that experience of mindful awareness and learning that this is really who and what I am. Then it's not just an idea, it's an experience, right? It's like, what's it like? It's like when you know something, right? When you know your dreams are dreams, whether they're good dreams or bad dreams, right? When you don't know that, in the world of dreams, they can all seem very real, right? But when you wake up, whether it was a good dream or a bad dream, right? A happy dream or a nightmare, you know it was just a dream, wasn't it? It doesn't disturb you, does it? Even though 5 minutes ago it arose, right? Once you know things are just dreams, then they don't disturb you, do they? Right? It's like that. It's that knowing. So, your question points in the right direction with, in the early stages, it's good to kind of get it straight in terms of what I'm going to identify with, but ultimately we'd like it to be a knowing, right? So it's not always, you know, every time something goes on, you go, is that the ghost or the host? Is that the host or the ghost or the guest? Which one is it? I mean, you know what I mean? We're always kind of, you know, our practice becomes like this work of always trying to remember. You know, like a lot of people say, now what am I supposed to do now? You know, what's teaching? There must be some practice for this. And what's practice? You know, I could go back to the book. Let me see, what am I supposed to be doing here? Again, when we don't know what we're doing, we need the manual, right? You know, if you don't know anything about plumbing and you're wanting to fix your faucet, you're probably good to have the book out there to kind of guide you step by step. But when you become more skillful at your plumbing, you don't need to take out the book, do you? You know what to do. You know what the problem is, and you know what the solution is. It's natural, right? Your plumbing skills are now ordinary. They're no longer special. Right? Is that clear? But again, you can't jump there. That's where people go, You know, if you don't know how to fix a faucet, get the manual and have it out there. Right? Once you've done it enough times, you don't need it right by the sink anymore. So, in the early stages of our practice, and people might go, well, I've been doing this a number of years. Early stage means until we get it. When you get it, you're no longer in the early stages. No need for a time frame. Okay, so we shouldn't fool ourselves, right? You know, if we realize, because we see the condition of our minds and the way we are still functioning or still suffering or still acting in an ignorant, pain-producing way or unskillful way, we still need probably to keep our manual close by. That's just smart, right? You know, there are some people who go, you know, they think they know everything. Oh, I can fix this, you know, and then they get out there with their wrenches and their this, and they take apart the faucet, and then they think, oh, it must be something else. Before you know, they've taken the whole mechanism apart, and there's water spouting everywhere, and they still think they can fix it. I'll take some more things apart. Right? Don't be like that. Until you really know what you're doing, keep your manual close by. And that's why it's good to have teachers and spiritual friends. Also to what? Sometimes it's good to have somebody who knows plumbing, right? Because sometimes even with the manual, we can't quite figure it out, can we? Right? So sometimes we need somebody who knows what they're doing to just, can you just show me how to do this? Or, I'm trying to do it, you know, you give them a call, I'm trying to do it, but it's like that. That's not an admission of failure, is it? No. It's smart. Even if you're faced with bad karma left over from the past or the five crimes that bring on the realm of incessant suffering, these will of themselves become the great sea of emancipation. I mean, any more questions about that? Yes. Like the bad things, like, I don't know, maybe you killed your mother, stuff like that.
No special meaning.
What?
No special meaning.
Yeah, it has special meaning. Yeah, I forget what they are, but I mean, oh yeah, in Buddhism, you know, everything is listed. So, when you get home, Google five crimes. They're called the five heinous crimes. They're like in the realm of karmic retribution, you know, some things are heavier than others. Right? Like, don't ever kill a Buddha. That'll really get you deep. Don't kill your mother, don't rape your sister. You know, it's an acknowledgement that there are certain types of actions that really cause great suffering to another human being, and therefore the result within oneself is quite harmful. Okay. But even that can be dealt with. You know, in the time of the Buddha, there was a serial killer called Angulimala, who had killed, I think, 99 people or something. He was what we call a serial killer. And he came to the Buddha, and the Buddha had a very powerful interaction with him. And Angulimala became a student of the Buddha, realized, and actually, supposedly, he attained some level of realization toward the end of his life. And he used to get beaten. Because, you know, in the Buddha's time, they would beg. You know, they had no food, so every day they would beg. And they would often, and they wandered. And so they would often come to villages where the villagers knew him. Even though now he had a shaven head and the whole thing and had renounced all that, they knew him. And of course, they had anger toward him. And so they would often physically attack him and beat him. And the Buddha counseled them, saying, this is just your pain for the harm you have done others. So just receive it in gratitude. That this is, you know, you're no longer creating that karma, so you have to be willing to accept the anger and resentment of those you've hurt. You have to be willing to. So it's a quite wonderful story. Any other questions about this? Yes. Well, yeah, that you will, as you begin this practice and watch your mind, you will notice that, right? Just like in your real life. there are people who just bother you mildly, and there are people who bother you quite profoundly, and there are people who just bother you now and then, and there are people who seem to just be always at it, right? It's sort of like that. And in the same way, it's not quite like this. There's a hierarchy within ourselves. There are, again, and why is that? It's just because of causes and conditions. So there are certain kind of mind states, et cetera, et cetera, that are more intense, and they are more frequent. Right? That's what you're talking about. And so over time, you begin to kind of see that, especially as the years go by of your practice, you begin to notice, many things are clearing up, but certain things seem to be, maybe somewhat better, but still appear fairly intractable. In other words, very much part of it. And again, all you're noticing, again, is simply the way your mind has been conditioned. It is not you. You are the host, right? But you become aware that certain guests tend to think they have priority rights in your home, right? And it's because in the past, we have made them comfortable, right? comfortable meanings we've welcomed them. Even if they have been uncomfortable, we still have made them comfortable because we have indulged them. We have repeatedly, even our resentment or our struggle with them is no different than our embrace of them. It's the same thing. It's, you know, one's coming from a positive point, one's coming negative, but it's our constant involvement in these negative states that have empowered them. Is that clear? And they're not going to go away overnight, as you've noticed. But again, they will. Because why? Because their nature is impermanent. They have no solidity. They have no permanence. They are just thoughts, feelings, and perceptions, which are just made up of mind stuff. They're like imprints in our mind. Okay? So it is simply the way we just said, which is, first of all, you have to label them correctly. Right? I mean, this is, you know, this is mindfulness is the gatekeeper. Right? I mean, many times we don't recognize them until they're already inside and running amok. You know, then we go, oh. So you want to get better and better and better and better and better with your mindfulness to kind of notice them when they're just arising. Okay? And they are arising not because you want them to, but because of conditioning. They just arise. So the issue in practice becomes, what do I do when they've arisen? The same way, you know, is my mind going to be an ocean of emancipation or is it going to be an ocean of suffering? So at that point, it becomes, you know, how do I skillfully, right, deal with this afflictive emotion or mind state or whatever you want to call it? And again, your capacity to label it and see it for what it is, to not give it any play or as little play as possible. And especially in the early stages, over time, just one's mindfulness and awareness and looking right at it is enough for it to dissipate. But often in time, in earlier time, we need to really provide an antidote, right? Which is some kind of statement of understanding that puts things in perspective, if it's in relationship to yourself, let's say, about whatever it is, right? Or if it's in relationship to someone else, we understand that in that moment we are distorting things, right? We are seeing this individual, this situation, in a very kind of one-dimensional way, in a very one-sided way. We're not seeing the fullness of the person and the situation. So again, that misperception can be corrected. Right, and traditionally in Buddhism, also after that is the generation of compassion or loving kindness, where we really generate the opposite. Right, we want to, and that's part of the reconditioning of our mind. Right, that we're now conditioning our mind in the realm of understanding, of acceptance, of kindness, of friendship, of, you know, all the... Because again, we do know that we all have friends or family that are, you know, that many other people may see as fairly obnoxious, many other people may see as not nice, and yet because they're our family, or we love them or care for them, we are very what toward them? We're very accepting. It's interesting, right? So that shows us that we all have that capacity, right? That things that in people we love or care about, that we can generate that kind of understanding or acceptance of, that we find intolerable when someone else is doing it. Now, why is that? I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it? Right? Or why is that? If our dear friend told us about this mind state, this afflictive mind state that arose in them, we can be very understanding and compassionate and wise in how we tell them how to deal with it. But when it arises in us, you know, we want nothing to do with it. Right? Now, why is that? I mean, what's the difference? So is that helpful? Yeah. But again, I mean, the important thing is that it be dealt with, and it be dealt with in a different way. I mean, if we continue to let it run amok, and, you know, we will just continually be, you know, replicating, and it will stay as powerful as ever and as frequent as ever. Again, some things go away fairly quickly. Some things stay much longer. But again, if they are handled in the skillful, wise way, over time, they will dissipate. And that's not because this is some kind of mystical, alchemical process we're involved in. It's just because these things are just have arisen because of conditioning. They've been maintained because of conditioning. And now we are unconditioning our response to them. Yes. Seized by one's demons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about that when you talk.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good, So that's a good question, and it's sort of similar, but it's good. I mean, the question is, I know I'm repeating it. The question is, this gentleman has a friend who, in his own internal process, refers to his mind being seized by demons. And the question that was asked is this kind of general way of mindfulness and awareness and just seeing things and then just letting them kind of be and unfold, is this enough? Or sometimes is some kind of, I think you're saying really, some kind of psychological understanding necessary? And again, we need to be practical, sort of like I said about the manual, you know, to say, you know, I should really know this does not mean you know it. And even if you've, you know, fixed it many times before, but you still are struggling, please get the manual or call somebody. So again, I think the proof is in the pudding. Again, it depends where one is developmentally. To me, if someone is telling you he feels taken over by demons, right, or you know, then he's really feels that whatever is taking him over is something like, indigenous to him, and you know, just takes him over. You know, it's like, and he doesn't have any sense of what they are, other than these terrible mind states or impulses, right? So, in that sense, sometimes having a kind of historical, psychological understanding of them may be helpful to see that they're not demons, they're not devils that have taken over his mind from outside, but that are simply things that have arisen in his mind because of past events. You know what I mean? In a sense, that kind of normalizes it. You don't, you know, you're not crazy, you're not possessed. This is a response to things that have happened in your life, and you know, and then the way you responded to how things happened in your life. And so I think that kind of more traditional in our Western model of psychology, or you know, understanding the history, can be helpful in that way. But the problem, you know, the shortcoming of that traditional model is it doesn't mean we're going to be free of it, even though we have great understanding, right? So we can be in therapy for many years and understand about our wounded inner child and all that, but still be afflicted by those kinds of emotions. And, you know, so in Buddhism, going back to the Buddha, the psychological impetus is for liberation from suffering. It's not just from coping better with suffering. But again, if one's at a place where one is overwhelmed by suffering, certainly learning to cope better with your suffering is certainly better, isn't it? Is that clear? So it's not, don't turn it into either or. We got to be careful. To me, it's a developmental model. And one has to decide where one is developmentally, not where one like to be developmentally. Right? And the proof is in the pudding. It's sort of like what I, in answer to Cheryl's question, I mean, certain types of mind states, even painful ones, tend to be more workable. Other ones tend to be much more overwhelming, and we have to have different responses to different things that arise in our mind. Any other questions? We'll just continue for a few more moments and then we'll have lunch. Students these days haven't the slightest comprehension of the Dharma. They're like sheep poking with their noses. Whatever they happen on, immediately they put into their mouths. If the shoe fits, wear it. Students these days haven't the slightest comprehension of Dharma. That's the Buddha's teachings, the practices. They're like sheep, but whatever they happen upon, they immediately put in their mouth. They can't tell a gentleman from a lackey. Can't tell a host from a guest. Okay? They can't tell the difference between real gold and fool's gold. They can't separate the chaff from the wheat. Right? All kinds of, these days, all kinds of quote-unquote spiritual teachings, it's endless, right? The smorgasbord of what's offering is endless. And one can endlessly gorge oneself on different practices and different teachings and different books and different videos. You know what I mean? It's just endless. But he's saying, how can you tell what's true and what's false? Right? What's real gold and what's fool's gold? What's a diamond and what's zirconium? People don't know the difference. People like that come to the Buddha's way with twisted minds, rushing in wherever they see a crowd. Everybody's going to see this teacher, they run to see that teacher. Everybody's going to get this initiation, or go to this workshop, they run to this one. This is the latest book on the spiritual bookshelf, they run to buy that one. As soon as they hear about anything, they go running this way and that. Right? They don't deserve to be called... Now, this was written back in the 9th century, so he does use the male... Can't be called true men, but we'll call them true people. They don't deserve to become a true person. And he's actually talking to monks, so that's why. Because who have left the household. All they are, in fact, is men of secular life. Someone who has truly left household life, and here he's referring, again, these are monks, but we can understand them as someone who's really practicing the Dharma. Must know how to act ordinary and how to have a true and proper understanding. Must know how to tell Buddhas from devils, to tell the true from the sham, to tell common mortals from sages. If they can tell these apart, then you could be called a true person of the way. But if you can't tell a Buddha from a devil, then all you've done is left one household to enter another. I mean, does that make sense? Again, that is why in our culture, which is not a spiritual culture, it is a culture that kind of knows or respects people by externals, if you're a multi-billionaire or if you're ahead of some powerful thing, then you get respected, or if you're a celebrity and have beauty, there are all these external things that we would say, oh, this is a, you know, this is a rich person, or this is a powerful person, or this is a celebrity. They're kind of, you know what I mean? We don't really know any of these people by really how they are, but we know them by their externals. Is that clear? And so what he's talking about here is, how do you know, you know, I mean, a Buddha doesn't necessarily look all that different from everybody else, right? It's a human being. I mean, we know the picture of the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, but if you didn't know who they were, and you just saw them in a lineup of other Tibetans or Vietnamese, you wouldn't pick them out as anything special, right? So how do you know what's genuine? You see what I'm saying? You know, outwardly a diamond and zirconium may look the same. Fool's gold and real gold may look the same. An authentic antique and somebody who's made an authentic antique. How do you know the difference? You see. So this is what he's getting at. There, you have to be able to know. In the same way, he says we have to know ourselves so we can get a sense of who we are authentically, know what an authentic feeling is within ourselves, you know, what's true and authentic within ourselves. The same way we need to learn to recognize it in those around us, so we won't be fooled, we won't be taken in. Is that clear? And again, that comes from discernment, having a discerning mind, looking deeply. So if you are, you know, in a process of seeking some kind of spiritual path, some kind of spiritual community, some kind of spiritual teachers, it's good to not be taken in by the externals, by the hoopla, by the forms, but, you know, look for genuineness, look for meaning, and then you will... hopefully not be so easily fooled. And we'll end then. Someone asked Lin Chi, what do you mean by the true Buddha, the true Dharma, and the true way? Would you be good enough to explain it to us? And notice he didn't shout or hit the person with a stick. The master said, Buddha, this is the cleanness and purity of the mind. Dharma, this is the shining brightness of the mind, the way. This is the pure light that is never obstructed anywhere. The three are in fact one. All are empty names and have no true reality. So here he's bringing us back to practice, back to awareness, back to mindfulness. Right. Words, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the way, what are these things? Actually, the mind. When you have let go of all your obstructing thinking, when you've let go of all your dramas of past, present, and future, and you're just resting in wakefulness, the mind clear, present, awake. In that moment, you have a pure mind, don't you? Your mind is pure. Right? When you're listening and just listening, when you're tasting, soon you'll be eating your lunch. See if you can eat your lunch with a pure mind. Just experiencing the look, the taste, the feel, the pure experience. This is the purity of experience, the purity of mind. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are not found outside of ordinary life. But it's ordinary life, again, where there's total presence and awareness. One doesn't need, when one's eating, to say, this is delicious. Before you said, this is delicious, there was something that knew it was delicious. Do you know what that is? Are you willing to trust that? Is that clear? There is something before thought that knows. many people, like someone speaking to you, and you find your head is nodding. You're not telling your head to nod, are you? Something knows, right? You just smile. Did you tell your, you know? No. What? Yeah, see, there's something that's just very natural. See, that's your ordinary mind. You see how wonderful it is? It's when something makes it happy, it just smiles. If something makes it sad, it just gets sad, you know. But you don't have to think it, do you? That's your ordinary natural mind. Everybody here has that wonderful mind. We have to learn to trust it and to rest in it. Okay? So it is now 12:30. From 12:30, there will be mindful eating. Hope everybody brought their lunch. If there's somebody that didn't bring their lunch, look hungry, and hopefully somebody else who did bring their lunch may give you a few tidbits. And those of us who did bring our food, please look around a little bit to see if anybody is hungry. We need to feed each other. And so there will be lunch and then a rest period for the next hour. Eating is going on downstairs. Tables are set up or something. And of course, if you want to go outside, you're welcome to do that. And then if you want to rest somewhere, go for a walk around the property or come up here. Some people like to come in here and rest a little bit. Feel free to do that. And then at 1:20, the bell will be sounded outside, giving you a 10-minute warning. And then come back in, and there'll be mindful movements that are led by Jacqueline, good yoga instructor. And but again, it's not difficult yoga, just again, learning to move in mindfulness. Then there'll be guided meditation by Charlie. Good job. And then I will be back, and we'll do some more practice together and have a little more discussion. And then we'll have our closing circle. Okay, everything clear? So please, again, we began at 9, it's 12:30, we're halfway done. Again, give yourself a little break today. Just, you know, do your best to just be present the way we talked, and see if whether you can cultivate that awareness of host, and that all the things that are going on around you and within you are just arising and passing. They're just guests. Be at ease.